One of the hallmarks of our times is movement. We travel as never before. And over the past 30 years, the world of travel has been completely transformed. The 90s was a world of paper tickets, guidebooks, and travel agents. Booking a trip meant phone calls and a level of uncertainty. Today, it takes just a few taps on a smartphone. The rise of budget airlines has made international travel more accessible than ever, while apps like Airbnb, Google Maps, and Uber have transformed how we stay, navigate, and move around. Social media turns destinations into viral hotspots, reshaping how and why we travel. To help us look back at how travel has transformed over the last 30 years and how it's changed us societally and psychologically and culturally, we're joined by someone who's been on the front line of travel journalism for decades, the legendary travel writer and broadcaster Simon Calder. You've likely read his columns, seen him on TV, or heard his expert advice on everything from last-minute getaways to airline strikes. Simon, welcome to the We Society podcast. I must ask you this, actually, because you must have thought, me, the We Society podcast, what's going on? What was your first reflection when we invited you?
Oh, my first reflection was, obviously I'm a loyal listener, but my first thing was, well, look, this is all about learned social science, and I'm a mathematician by training who kind of stumbled into travel journalism, and therefore I'm not sure if I'm the right candidate. Let's find out.
Well, I think it's going to be very enjoyable talking to you. That intro was rather kind of grandiloquent description of travel as a dimension of kind of modern times that actually really has been transforming the way we act, think, behave. I mean, would you buy that?
Oh, yes. It's been fantastic. So let's go back exactly 30 years. Nobody had heard of an airline called EasyJet. I remember receiving an invitation to their launch, but I put it in the pile of ideas which will never work. I was comprehensively wrong. And just through that no-frills revolution, suddenly the idea of flying to the south of France was not something you might save up for and do every couple of years. It was something that you could do next weekend. The way that the low-cost airlines have transformed our expectations and opened everything up. I think when I get sad about the UK and Europe, at least I think that EasyJet, Ryanair and all the rest have made us better Europeans simply by making Europe more accessible to us.
I don't think I've ever heard such unapologetic praise for EasyJet and Ryanair. I mean, usually people are kind of complaining about being crammed on these planes, no seats, kind of. It's all very tricky. But you're an unapologetic kind of advocate.
Well, and those two airlines are the safest airlines in the world as well, in terms of the number of passengers they have flown, in the case of Ryanair, over 2 billion without a fatal accident. So not only are they extraordinarily good at extracting that last £5 for choice of seat or overpriced cheese sandwich, they are also experts at getting you to your destination safely. So I was going to say I won't hear a word said against them. I will hear plenty of words said against them, but their hearts are in the right place.
Now, societally, I mean, what's this doing to us?
Oh, it's enriching us as travellers so much. And if you're thinking, well, no, that actually only applies to middle-class people who can afford to fly often these. Well, no, if you look at the national minimum wage, if you worked for 2 weeks doing a 40-hour week at the national minimum wage, you would earn enough to fly to Australia and back. And that is such an opportunity that the cost of travel, which when we were growing up, we were hitchhiking everywhere because it was simply the only possible way of getting to your
destination.
Yes,
that's certainly true of me, Anna.
I think there is a future in a kind of well-tuned technological hitchhiking. But the great thing is that our horizons are impossibly wider. And not only are we being enriched by the places that we go to, by the people we meet, the food we eat, the sights we see, at the same time, those communities, almost all of which I claim are less wealthy than the one that we're coming from, it enriches them initially financially, which is very important. Tourism is absolutely the closest thing that anybody can get to free money. If you live in Amsterdam or Barcelona or Dubrovnik or Venice think we've got way too much tourism, but 99.9% of locations would just love more tourism because we bring in money, we create jobs, we pay taxes, and we also bring ourselves, and we're quite interesting. And to any location, the fact here in London where we're talking, that millions of people are coming to London makes one feel rather proud of the place. We can talk about the environment. We can talk about isolated bits of over-tourism. But as a force for good, I think it beats pretty much any other industry hands down. Thank you.
Well, you have been advocating it for 30 years. But I just want to kind of unpack a little bit of what you just said. I mean, in what way do you think it's enriching? And in what way do you think it's changed people?
It's something you cannot directly calibrate, but it happens at a different rate to other people. The all-inclusive holiday, which I am sorry to say has been relentlessly increasing in popularity, is really the antithesis of pompously what I would call good tourism, because you are going to a resort. It almost doesn't matter where it is. There's going to be high walls around it. You're going to have a special wristband to show that you are entitled to the industrial scale catering they are offering. Your idea of a good holiday may well be to ambitiously consume as much as you possibly can, food and alcohol, in order to feel that you've made a profit on the trip. But you know, that's the market, and I very much hope that in the course of people going to wherever it happens to be, Tunisia, Egypt, Morocco, the Caribbean, wherever they are going, they are actually at least finding out a little bit about the location they are in. There's still the 21st century equivalent of guidebooks, and many, many people are perfectly happy to go independently and make their own discoveries and their own friends.
That's one thing I find when I travel, actually, is that I am still a kind of devotee of the guidebook. Bologna recently, or actually Athens too. The guidebook was actually an essential part of my pleasure. And actually, you can't quite get it off your smartphone. I mean, it's kind of someone's really thought about how to structure your experience. That's one aspect of what we've left behind that I'm slightly kind of sad about. I mean, would you buy that or not?
Oh, look, you can look at any graph you like of guidebook sales, and it looks cataclysmic. Clearly, it was absolutely dreadful during COVID, because guess what? If people aren't travelling, they generally don't need guidebooks. And there is some evidence that actually the nature of a guidebook, which is, as you say, structured, curated, somebody whose job it is to pad the streets, to go and check all these budget hostels and see what they're like, and then recommend the best ones. I've done plenty of that, and I think a fairly noble pursuit, but monetizing it is tricky. And actually, there is a business model which would see almost kind of guidebooks updated in real time on a tablet or whatever, so that you're getting all the benefits of a guidebook, but you're also getting the fact that actually that station closed, or that restaurant has changed its name or whatever. So there are ways around it. And yeah, I think people who do, like me, like you, travel with guidebooks will always believe that we are getting a slightly richer experience than those who are just reliant on what they've seen, dare I say it, on TikTok.
Now, let's just talk economics for a second. For countries like Greece, you know, tourism is north of a fifth of GDP, not quite so high, but of a similar order of magnitude in France and Italy and Spain. I mean, Britain's right up there too, actually. I mean, it's a very important revenue source. And yet, you know, there are critics that will say environmentally destructive. They'll say that it's not just Dubrovnik and Paris and Venice who are kind of pushing back. It's also, you know, the seaside resorts in South Wales who are kind of worried about it, like Tenby, you know. I mean, overrun. That's very much the experience in southwest England, in Cornwall, for example. The whole phenomena of second homes and tourist spots crowding out the locals. You know, you're trying to present it as a kind of, this is all upside.
Oh no, it is overwhelmingly upside. But let's talk about those issues that you have raised. So let's go to Tenby. There are problems there in terms of property, in terms of people being priced out of the market, in terms of people who work locally having to live in Swansea and travel in or whatever. And that isn't great, but it's not specifically tourism in the sense of people who will go to a location, they'll stay in a B&B or a hotel. Those places are designed for us as tourists. If you want to rent a lovely beachside Airbnb, or you want to buy a second house there, be aware that you are displacing local people. And if you are comfortable trespassing on their stock of accommodation, then, well, that's your choice. Personally, I prefer just to stay in places, including campsites, for instance, where tourists are supposed to be, and that avoids distorting the accommodation market. And you can go from Tenby to Barcelona, where huge protests at the over-tourism of that city. And look, in the middle of August, it's not a pleasant place to stroll down the Ramblas. But actually, what really seems to be upsetting the locals that I've talked to is the distortion of the local housing market. And that's because investors will come in, they will buy an entire block of flats, not because they think this will greatly increase the housing stock for the Catalans, but because they think we can punt these out on Airbnb for much more than we would collect in rents. And people will do it because they will be having a better experience than in a hotel. And if you're going to have those kinds of decisions being made, it is incumbent on the local authority to start regulating that, start putting taxes on, to start banning short-term lets, which are not going back to the old hippie ethos of Airbnb, which is, hey, San Francisco, convention on, I've got a couch, somebody can sleep there, pay me $20, and that's great. But now Airbnb is a different beast, and like any gigantic corporation, it needs to be regulated.
Yes, I think most people listening to this will say, right on, Simon, you've got that one, hole in one. But it's very tricky to do. The short let market, Airbnb, has without doubt distorted the housing market. I think residents of Barcelona, Rome, Amsterdam would say the same, actually, that there's a limit to how many hotel rooms you want. You know, you want schools, you want museums, you want the artifacts of life that goes to make a city a living thing for the inhabitants. And actually, tourism are like a virus, actually. When they reach kind of a certain critical mass, it starts to go exponential. It does become very problematic. And actually, there is a kind of international kickback against it. And, and you can understand it. I mean, you're going to hold out. You're going to say, come on, folks. Nearest thing to kind of free money, and it brings jobs. And
no, oh, my goodness me, definitely not. I am absolutely with the deputy mayor of Venice when he wants to introduce a tax on day trippers. I would simply say €5, which is what it started off at, make it 50. And don't do it all the way through the year, because this is a place of immense cultural wealth that anybody should be able to access. But I'm afraid if you want to see it for free, you'll probably have to come along on a wet Wednesday in November, not on a peak Saturday in July. Dubrovnik, and I've just spoken to the mayor of that fine Croatian city, and he's actually got a plan. We'll see how successful it is. But the local authority is cracking down on apartments in the old town. I went down one street, just a short street of, I think, 14 properties, and all but two were listed as tourist apartments. So they're now buying some of those back, giving them to young families, taking a former palace and turning that into a school. So trying properly to transform this back into the city that it perhaps was before cruise ships started arriving, for instance. And now, if you are a cruise ship, you're going to be limited on how long you can stay. You've actually got to stay a minimum length of time. So it's not just, right, everybody pile down to the old city through the Pillar Gate and go and have a wander around, buy an ice cream, and then back on the boat. You have more meaningful experiences, but also reducing the number of ships that call. And those are brave things to do, because it's, as I was saying, free money. Amsterdam's doing the same sorts of things. Taxes gradually being racked up there, which are going to displace a number of people. Or, I would say, send them down the road to Rotterdam. What a fantastic city that is. Not quite the cultural heft that Amsterdam has, but in terms of cutting-edge art and museums and so on, it's great. And so, in a sense, the more hurdles, the higher the cost that over-touristed places put in, that's great, because it just spreads the joy.
I mean, you talked about the 2 billion passengers that actually the budget airlines had taken, anyone who's on the kind of green wing of British politics would have said, bloody hell, you know, that's sapped the jet stream, denuded the oxygen. That's not good news. I mean,
oh,
we should be...
It's absolutely terrible. And I would so desperately love to say, right, everybody, the European railways have got their act together. You can now go from London via Paris or Brussels or Amsterdam to any city you want within a, let's say, 500-mile radius of London, and you will have smooth connections. You'll be able to book it really easily. But I'm afraid, during the course of this answer, I could go onto my smartphone. I could buy a ticket from Manchester to Malaga. It would cost me about maybe £80. It would take me to book about 2 minutes. And the actual flight, obviously, would be 3 hours. Now, if I go onto any app you name and try and do the same thing on a train, I will need to make 4 minimum separate transactions, and they will not be joined up, so that if my train from Manchester to Euston is late, then Eurostar won't necessarily let me on the next train from St Pancras because it's a separate booking. Europe's railways, they just desperately need to learn from aviation how to join things up and to have a holistic system. At the moment, it's a joke, and exacerbated in an economic sense by the very, very strong monopoly position that Eurostar has, which means that often the kind of entry-level price, if you're booking late on to get to Paris, is £200 one way. And look, here's 4 different airlines which are going to cost you £60. For there to be such a strong financial incentive to fly just 200 miles is absolutely mad. But the railways need to address that. But aviation, yeah, very much accelerating. I could give you all the greenwash about sustainable aviation fuel, and it's all going to be great, and we're all going to be flying around with the waste product from vegetable oil. That's absolutely not going to happen. There is not enough of the stuff. It's too expensive. If you are told sustainable aviation fuel is going to solve aviation's environmental harm, guess what? It won't. Electric power, that does have sort of some role, but unfortunately, as with so many things to do with transport and power, the energy density of fossil fuels is so much higher than anything you can do with a battery.
We'd like to tell you about another podcast from our friends over at The Conversation. They're a not-for-profit news and analysis platform pairing academics with journalists on every story. In their podcast, The Conversation Weekly, host Gemma Ware sits down with an academic expert every week to discuss a topic in the news to understand how we got here. From global politics to the latest scientific breakthroughs or the big dilemmas facing our planet, they talk to experts from all over the world who draw on years of research knowledge to pull out what really matters so that you can understand the context without the spin. New episodes of The Conversation Weekly land every Thursday. Find them wherever you get your podcasts. There is climate change. I mean, part of me is kind of enjoying, as I speak to you, the kind of unwoke celebration of travelling and different food and different clothes and different sights and the wonderfulness of it. And actually, I share that. Another part of me is thinking, you know, actually, haven't we got to kind of contain this a bit?
Oh, yeah. Well, of course we have. But again, that's down to governments. That's down to...
Well, no, come on, individuals have responsibilities as well. I have friends who actually do refuse to fly. I mean, they will take the train.
Yeah,
I mean, as a statement about the climate change.
Yep, and I talk to people who absolutely do that, who will limit their horizons, and that, I absolutely respect that. But I would suggest that is absolutely not a mainstream view. 1995, when EasyJet started, was also, I think, the first year that ABTA, the Travel Association, put a question in their survey saying, yeah, we're looking at the environment. Would you pay maybe £20 more for your holiday if it had less of an environmental impact, maybe less of an impact on the local community? And everybody said, yes, yes, yes. Did they? Heck, of course they didn't. They just went for what was cheap and hot. And while there is so much demand for people, for example, going to the Egyptian Red Sea in July and August, which is, by any accounts, a ridiculous time to go there.
That is seriously hot.
Yeah. then if you want to address that, if you want to nudge people, I'm afraid you have to use taxation. And of course, the airline industry will squeal, but you can change behaviours like that. It's simply a question of whether there is a government brave enough to do that. And you would obviously also want to reward people who are flying on more modern aircraft, which have less of an impact, and you would absolutely make business class and first class stratospherically expensive, because guess what? You're lying there in your flatbed in business class. You are effectively causing as much damage as four of us sitting down the back in economy.
Which is where you sit, of course.
Well, yeah, of course. I'm not paying business class fares. Thank you very much.
It's a sign of my advancing age, but I've begun to enjoy going to some of the kind of lesser grand homes of the kind of English gentry, the 16th and 18th century in kind of middle England. The grand tour features, I mean, endlessly, you know, the Earl of this, the Baron of there have been on the grand tour, and they've written poetry, and there's pictures of them on the wall there, and there's the artifacts they brought back. But it was a thing.
Mm-hmm.
Throughout the 18th century, you were unfinished
if you hadn't
experienced it. And if you, yeah. You know, and the Italian garden or whatever it might be that were brought back and exponents of it here in England, it does kind of speak to your case that actually it was kind of understood that if you were a well-to-do, even minor English aristocrat in 1750, you spent 2 years on the road.
People, I think, naturally want to know, what's over that hill? What happens downstream on this river, across that sea? I've heard stories of this fabled city 5 days walk away. I want to know more about that. Of course you do. And humanity has spread, well, partly through economic necessity, but also, I think, through curiosity. And we are all the richer for it. And the great thing is, so I was, for complicated reasons, on my way here, talking to people in Newcastle, and they were heading off on holiday, lovely couple, married 25 years ago. They're going back to Corfu, where they went on their honeymoon. Another couple of widowed ladies heading for a lovely hotel in Alicante. And just the joy of them setting off on their relatively modest expeditions, just knowing that that is within so many people's grasp, and that the democratization of these experiences that you speak so eloquently of has been a transformative thing. Honestly, I really, really cherish the fact that my daughters are in their 20s. Well, first of all, they don't need to hitchhike anywhere. And when they were younger, and I insisted that we would hitchhike with them, they were very grumpy about it.
I think hitchhiking with your parents, I mean, that's a car. not the point at all.
But they can go to so many places. And I don't just mean fly off to Dubai, just going around the UK. And again, we were priced out of it 30 years ago. So it all depends on your journey. But if you are a canny traveller, you can make the most of Britain as well and stay in budget hotels, not Airbnbs.
I can't allow a podcast with one of the greatest travel writers of our generation.
I saw the producer's notes. It said cheap and available.
Well, everyone's cheap. We all do it for pro bono on the We Society podcast, including the presenter. But having spoken so well, you know, here we are, the autumn of 2025. Where do you fancy? What's your favourite destination?
Well, of course, I don't know, because I haven't checked them out by any means, and I'm just going to as many as I can.
You've been doing it for 30 years. There's hardly anywhere in the world you haven't been.
Oh, no, there's so many places, honestly. For example, Armenia, the first place during COVID I was unable to go to. I had a trip all booked and I was looking forward to it. Couldn't go there. Quite a lot of the former Soviet Union, which I find thrilling, possibly because I'm old enough to remember the Cold War. There's so much of Africa I haven't seen. I feel barely touched that wonderful continent. Honestly, I just don't know where it will be. I can certainly say that if you want some unspoilt, thrilling islands that are very easy to get to and fantastically cheap. Go to the Azores. If you want some deep culture and something quite adventurous, Uzbekistan would seem to be the obvious place.
Uzbekistan?
But, yeah. It was one of the key locations along the Silk Road, and you have from this bizarre Soviet capital Tashkent, you then go to Samarkand on Central Asia's only high-speed train, you explore all that, then you go to Bukhara, which is so intensely Islamic, and then, my goodness, here's Khiva, one of those rare places where I just sat on a rooftop and just...
Do you go by yourself when you're travelling, or do you take a partner, or do you like to travel by yourself?
I do a lot of travelling by myself, and if we can just divert into that. While I love... You know, travelling with other people, travelling on your own is a very special concept because you are naturally more open to the people that you meet. And look, I'm saying this as an older white male. I know it would be very different for a lot of the people who are listening, but I take joy in encounters with people. But I'm also, my goodness, in terms of destinations, here's one for you, actually, Will. If you had to, and let's see if you come up with the most common answer, if you had to restrict your holidays to one country in the world for the rest of your life, which country would that be?
Really tricky. I think Italy.
Yep, that's the correct answer. Or it's the most common answer, because clearly you have an astonishing depth of history. You've got the highest mountain in Western Europe.
Beaches, museums, food. The variety, actually, the sheer variety of it, from Tuscany down to Puglia, you know, even Sicily, you know, it's extraordinary.
Yeah. And how lucky are we to be able to say, Spain, France, Croatia, Greece, wherever, I'll come up with Italy. So we've tasted enough of these places. So it's
I'm a fan of travel in Europe, actually. I'm not madly enamoured of going to North America, South America, I've done it, and Africa, but actually the... And Asia, I find that the jet lag really gets me.
Mm-hmm.
When you asked me that question, I was thinking, there's Germany, which is also a kind of underexplored. Mm. I mean, we kind of write Germany off, and Berlin's an extraordinary city. So I kind of, there's a lot there, actually.
Oh, there is. And that is absolutely the winner of the most overlooked country in Europe. And that, I'm afraid, you talk to tourism people in Germany and they say, yep, it's squarely down to the war, even though that ended 80 years ago. Somehow in tourism, we have very long memories, but you're quite right. Germany is a wonderful country, and anybody who has not explored it in depth, I urge you to do so. There are wonders at every turn.
At the very beginning, you were talking about the social science of travel. I mean, are there yet kind of academic studies and academic discipline opening up? I mean, have you been invited to give lectures on it? I mean, where are we going with tourism? There's a slight sense, and I even felt it when, you know, briefing myself to talk to you, I thought, this is kind of, I'm going to enjoy it, but it's kind of slightly, you know, frivolous, you know.
This yes, it is. It's not serious. It's not education. It's not health. It is frivolous, but it is the great, I think, the greatest joy that we can share. So where's it going? There are extraordinarily good tourism academics. There are more and more people studying tourism in a way that goes beyond the run a good hotel.
Yeah.
And that's terrific. I would not for one moment number myself amongst those. I simply want to ensure that as many people as possible have as rich experiences as possible and enjoy the freedom that this generation has above any other to travel to meet people from different cultures. And of course, sorry to kind of round off with something which sounds a little bit cliche, but actually to find out that there is far more that unites us than divides us. So I think it does have a lot of social good about it, as well as being fantastic fun.
I tried to tease it out of you, and you turned the question back on me. It could give you a chance to name two places. One, what's the place that you would most recommend? And what is the place where you've had the most happy time as a travel journalist?
Oh, well, as a travel journalist, I would just say as a traveller, the place, and I can remember it as though it were yesterday, I was 19, hitchhiking through Spain, which in those days was not a great experience, but finally made it to Granada. And I just remember on the hill, looking across the valley to the Alhambra, a place of such astonishing beauty that I just thought, this is, I hope, the first of many, many wonders that I will be lucky enough to see. And certainly it was, but, you know, raised hairs on the back of my neck, just thinking about such intense beauty. And look, you said, which country in the world has
place or city,
yeah,
or...
Yeah,
I've beach got, or mountain. You're gonna.
I climb mountains partly because I'm scared of heights, but nothing is better than making your way back down to a city. And look, I include in that polluted, messy old Kathmandu, certainly Mumbai, Mexico City. I just love just a big city full of energy, full of great places to eat, full of fantastic people to meet. And so just name your mega city and I will be happy there.
I didn't expect that. A mega city.
Well, we can talk about cities till the cows come home. And cities are really important and they need to be bound together, and they're places of ideas and creativity. And I just love them for that. But I'm also happy to wander lonely as a cloud through some mountains, as long as I know that at the end of the journey, at the end of the week, I will be back in the middle of a great city.
Simon, thank you very much. It's been kind of exhilarating actually talking to you. You feel your enthusiasm for travel and for place and for all that it implies just kind of comes over. And I hope listeners enjoy it as much as I've done. Thank you very much.
It's been absolutely my pleasure.
Thank you so much for listening. The We Society is brought to you by the Academy of Social Sciences in association with the Leverhulme Trust and the Nuffield Foundation. I'm Will Hutton, the producer is Emily Finch, and it's a Whistle Down production. If you haven't already, please subscribe to the podcast, leave a comment, share with your colleagues and friends. And thank you so much for listening.